Hello, folks, and welcome to Leaky Weekly, the show where we dive into the last week or so of news in the world of data leaks, cybercrime, and the dark web. Now, before we get started, a quick disclaimer that a lot of what we talk about comes from the word of threat actors themselves or from journalists on emerging stories. So take everything with a grain of salt and always wait for, you know, more details to emerge. Now, the theme of today's show is ransoms. And I don't necessarily mean ransomware in every case. So I think you'll find these stories very interesting. Without further ado, I'm your host, Nick. I've got excruciatingly detailed notes for today's stories. And let's get started. So for our first story, new ransomware just dropped. And I don't mean variant. I don't mean someone's code leaked. I mean a sort of new category has emerged. Palo Alto's research team, Unit 42, uncovered an extortion campaign that involved attackers exfiltrating data from AWS cloud storage containers, specifically in this case, S3, AWS S3, S3 buckets, you may have heard of them, and leaving a ransom note behind. So they didn't encrypt the data, as ransomware often does. They just took it and left a note. And they did this by scanning over 230 million unique targets for exposed ENV files. So specifically, Unit 42 tracked about 110,000 domains being targeted by the campaign and roughly 90,000 unique environment variables in ENV files that had hard-coded keys of some kind, several thousand of them being AWS access keys. In case you're unfamiliar, these ENV files, which especially if they contain secrets, are certainly not supposed to be internet-facing, contain configuration variables used by applications, in this case, web apps. And in many cases, a configuration variable is something like an API key, a database login, or maybe an AWS access key. So for the life cycle of this attack, first, the attacker scans the internet for exposed ENV files. Next, they search the contents of any ENV files they had for AWS access keys. And evidently, they're looking for other kinds of access keys too, but for now, we'll focus on the AWS access keys in this campaign. Then, using that AWS access key, they figure out what it is by sending it to the AWS API endpoint get caller identity, which tells them for this particular key, what's the user ID, what's the account number it's associated with, and what is the ARN. And the ARN has information like what region is the key in, what service is it using, what type of resource is it a user, is it a group, is it a role. And next, they send the key to the AWS API endpoint list users, which sends back a list of other IAM users in that AWS account, which they may later use for lateral movement within the environment. And then they request the list buckets endpoint, which lists the existing S3 buckets on the account, which they will target for exfiltration and extortion. Now, if the key they found has the appropriate permissions, they create a new IAM resource for themselves in the target environment and give themselves unlimited access. Next, they attempted to create a Lambda to spin up a VM in EC2. A virtual machine in EC2 is AWS's virtual machine ecosystem. And they would attempt to install a crypto miner on the virtual machine that they've spun up. Now, evidently, this step failed. So this isn't like a multi-stage harvesting commercial operation. But what didn't fail was another Lambda that they would create that would scan more targets using a file it pulled down from another S3 bucket in an AWS instance the attacker had previously compromised. In that bucket, by the way, Unit 42 found 110,000 domains with exposed ENV files that the threat actor was targeting. And in that bucket, that's what showed the roughly 230 million unique targets that the threat actor was scanning for on the internet for new exposed environment files. Now, the threat actor would exfiltrate that data, the data that was stored in the S3 buckets, and then upload a ransom note into that bucket. Now, I think it's another one of cybercrime's beautiful paradoxes that the threat actor left their ENV file exposed that contained all of the credentials they were collecting from their campaign that were evidently for all sorts of things, not just IAM, AWS access keys. But all kinds of cloud storage solutions, on-prem applications, social media accounts. About 90,000 of the variables were specifically access keys, and about 7,000 specifically were associated with cloud services, about 1,500 with social media accounts, and then, you know, many others for other services. Now, to be clear, when I say the attacker did X, Y, or Z, I don't mean they were in the terminal doing this by hand and crafting the requests to these AWS APIs, the entire lifecycle of this attack is automated. So the attacker really just set the script loose, kind of like a worm, and it would take over an AWS account, make itself an account, start scanning new targets. While doing that, exfiltrate the data and leave the note, get an access key to the next target from that Lambda, and then, you know, extrapolate infinitely. So Unit 42 also mentions in the report that the campaign looks like it started with Mailgun credentials, which is a service for automatically sending emails. So this probably started as an attack looking for Mailgun creds in exposed ENV files and sort of slowly blossomed into this extortion operation looking for all kinds of creds and acting like a worm self-replicating through AWS environments as the adversary learned of just how many things were exposed in these files and just how many of them were exposed on the internet. Now, there's a lot of takeaways here. I, in my humble opinion, believe this story is not getting nearly enough attention. Please read the report that's linked below. But, you know, cyber criminals know that a lot of people don't keep data on hosts or in on-prem apps anymore. So a successful ransomware campaign might not yield, it might yield a lot of data, but it might not yield a lot of interesting data. All that data probably lives in some third-party hosted web app or something in a cloud environment. So this is kind of a hint at the kinds of campaigns, and we've seen some like it before, but the kinds of campaigns that cyber criminals are more likely to engage in the future because it's easy and can be commodified. And as we've seen with like ransomware affiliate programs, with the growing info stealer underground, the easier and easier targets get to extort and the easier the, you know, exploitation process is, slowly but surely, these things make their way into highly commodified cybercrime operations where, you know, the sophisticated people, like the people who executed this attack, will build some kind of automated tooling for it. And then the masses will join as affiliates or pay for access to execute campaigns on their own, thus like dramatically increasing the reach of these kinds of operations. I also think this continues the trend of ransomware without the ware, or at least without the encryption. The where here is really just a bunch of lambdas. This isn't some portable executable. This is like lol bins or living off the LAN binaries on steroids, in the sense that none of this is based on some issue or vulnerability with AWS. These are exposed environment variables and over-permissed IAM resources. Sort of a callback to Snowflake, in that Snowflake sure maybe could have turned on by default way back in the day 2FA on accounts, and prevented some of the takeovers of their customer tenants. But ultimately, it's not like a vulnerability on Snowflake's end. This isn't a vulnerability on AWS's end. This is the software being used intentionally, but misconfigured, or maybe at times unconfigured. For our next story, NBC4i in Columbus, Ohio reports that the Reseda ransomware group infected the city of Columbus, Ohio. They then advertised a whopping 6.5 terabytes of stolen data, later on making about 45% of that available for public download, and claiming that this data they were listing for public download is that which wasn't already sold, implying that they sold about half of it. Now, often, a ransomware group will post a small sample to their data leak site to prove a compromise was real and release the entirety of the files or sell them after either negotiations have failed or they never started, they never heard from the victim, so they never got paid. However, the director of the Department of Technology for the city claims they never actually received a ransom demand from the group. He also said that they tried to reach out to the group before the data was released, but never got a response. Meanwhile, the group listed the entire 6.5 terabytes of data for sale for roughly 30 Bitcoin, I think, and obviously didn't sell all of it because they listed 3.1 terabytes for free to their data leak site, again, claiming this was the data that was not sold. Now, if it's true that Reseda didn't even engage in any contact with the victim, that would be maybe unsurprising ethically, but not common. The whole purpose of a ransomware operation is to try and extort your victim into paying you to decrypt their files, and nowadays, to double extort your victim by also threatening to subsequently auction off those files or release them to the general public if the ransom is not paid, both of which were supposedly done in this case. So all in all, a very confusing situation, made all the more confusing by our next story. NBC4i in Columbus, Ohio, reports that a security researcher by the name of Connor Goodwolf is being sued by the city of Columbus, Ohio, for telling them that they were hacked. Now, all of the details for this story and so many others related to the ransomware incident are on NBC4i.com/cityhack. I'll put the link down in the description. A lot of great write-ups there. I recommend you check it out. So Goodwolf read that the mayor of the city claimed that the 3.1 terabytes of data posted by the ransomware group online were encrypted and corrupted. So everyone was safe. This data was inaccessible. It was unusable. You know, nothing to worry about here. Now, Goodwolf went to the Reseda data leak site, looked at the data, which was posted by the threat actor and publicly accessible, and discovered that, in fact, it was not encrypted or corrupted at all. And that, in fact, sensitive data concerning the residents of Columbus, Ohio, was very much present in the data leak. Goodwolf left a voicemail with the city claiming that he was aware that someone in the Department of Technology was lying, and asked them to call him back so that he could walk them through all of the data that was actually exposed and not corrupted, and informed them that he was also going to the news to discuss the data that had been exposed with the people of Columbus. Now, shortly after this, the city attorney sues Goodwolf, stating that if there is information that needs to be brought forward, there is a way to disclose that information to law enforcement and not going directly to the media. And that is why we had to file this temporary restraining order, I think it's called. Now, perhaps no one was checking the voicemail box that day because the voicemail that I talked about was left, along with several other unanswered calls to the city, was left the day before he went to the news, indicating that he did indeed disclose that information to the concerned party. Now, Goodwolf has at least succeeded in making the public fully aware of the actual danger and breadth of the exposed data. But separate from this lawsuit, the city itself is facing two class action lawsuits brought forward by the police and firefighters, including an undercover officer who's worried that his cover has been blown by a specific set of police data that was present in the leak. And they're suing specifically over, you know, basically being kept in the dark by the city after claiming that they know they were exposed by the leak, in contradiction to the mayor saying this data is inaccessible and unusable. So the complaint against Goodwolf reads specifically, the defendant's actions of downloading from the dark web and spreading this stolen sensitive information at a local level have resulted in widespread concern throughout the Central Ohio region. Only individuals willing to navigate and interact with the criminal element on the dark web, who also have the computer expertise and tools necessary to download data from the dark web, would be able to do so. Okay, so what's the expertise in question here? Well, look no further than the notorious online criminal stronghold, YouTube.com, on which you will find advanced cybercrime entities like CNBC Make It, who will show you the highly technical requirements for accessing the dark web. Now, to demonstrate as an example, you go to any search engine, type in Tor browser, and click download. And boom, you now have the computer expertise and tools necessary. In my humble opinion, this lawsuit appears rather frivolous and represents, at best, a fundamental misunderstanding of technology. And at worst, a violation of public trust, as it remains unclear if residents or the implicated undercover police officers whose identities were revealed in the leaked police data would ever have learned that they were impacted by the leak. All right, folks, that is it for today's stories. Thank you again for joining us. And as a reminder, this show was brought to you by Flair, the world's easiest to use and most comprehensive cybercrime data set that integrates with your security program in 30 minutes. Sign up for our free trial, linked in the podcast description below, to try it yourself.